Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here at the annual SSP meeting. I have to apologize to see a couple of familiar faces from the STM meeting. You're going to see a similar presentation, but hopefully it will resonate more the second time around. My name is Darrell Gunter. I am the Chief Marketing Officer for Kolexis. Give you a little history and background on Kolexis. Kolexis started off as a company, really as an EU research project back in the 90s. You had a couple of graduate assistants who were working at Erasmus University who were getting a number of requests from developing countries for information about malaria and other region-specific diseases. And they had the idea that they were going to create a search engine for these developing countries. And they went forth and got a grant from the EU and the World Health Organization, and it was known as the SHARE Project. Well, the project was a success. The developing countries got a Rolls-Royce of a search engine, but the technology was sitting on a shelf owned by the Dutch government. The two development teams, one was in Geldermals in the Netherlands, the other one was in Germany, decided to form two companies. One was called Kolexis, the other was Sync Solutions. They started in 1999, and they were moving forward. And by 2002, 2003, they had acquired one customer in the United States, which was the NIH, very prestigious customer, but only one customer. The company was starting to fall on particularly financial hard times, and new investors came in 2005, and brought in Bill Kirkland, my boss, the CEO, and Steve Light, both from IBM. I was recruited over from Elsevier in April of 2007, and we've been marching along for the last 2 years, spreading the what I like to call the semantic wave gospel. What I want to talk about today is how metadata can really enrich your researcher's experience. Prior to Elsevier, I worked at Dow Jones for 13 years, selling Dow Jones News Retrieval and Dow Jones Financial News Services. And it always came down to, in my estimation, no matter what industry you're talking about, the user experience is all about eliminating clicks, getting them to the information that they need very quickly. And that's what the semantic search and semantic web will do for you. Well, let's talk about Kolexis technology. What we do is that we have 18 proprietary algorithms. We use mesh as our ontology in the life sciences, and we work with structured, unstructured data. We're able to aggregate vast amounts of data. From that data, we create what we call a fingerprint, a digital fingerprint of weighted relevant concepts. And these weighted relevant concepts are presented in a nice visualization, which you see to your right, which is what we call our fingerprint. And to give you an example, we resolve all of the linguistic challenges in stemming, lemmatization, and normalizing. It's multilingual, and of course we address the synonyms issue, the disambiguation of homonyms and abbreviations, so that we're able to make sure that if you're talking about Dolly, you're talking about Dolly the sheep and not Dolly Parton, the singer. From there, what can we do right now that really makes sense for the marketplace? Well, we're able to establish expert profiles, networks. You're able to do a knowledge discovery search and do what we like to call hypothesis generation. For expertise, expert profiles, here you have a profile of Professor Grifka from the Asklepios Hospital System in Germany. Asklepios is a 100-unit hospital system that utilizes our technology, working with all of their publishers that they subscribe to, whether it's Springer, Walters Kluwer, Elsevier. We have indexed their data, so we're able to create digital fingerprints of their experts. So as you can see here, this particular professor, doctor, he has published 129 articles, but the visualization to the left immediately allows you to see what are the key concepts that this gentleman focuses on. So it allows the reader, the user, the author, to immediately zero in on the key areas of expertise. Again, we allow you to explore instead of searching. If we were doing a search in one of the popular databases out there, ScienceDirect, you see Alzheimer's, you get a list of many articles which are very relevant. However, with our visualization to the right with a fingerprint, again, it allows the author to see what is in all of those 20,000 different items so that they can immediately zero in on that particular area of expertise that they want to focus on. Now, this is something that I think is very exciting when we talk about the co-occurrence of concepts. When you have a concept such as protomoors in Alzheimer's research, we have been able to, through our inverse vectoring process, to look at what concepts have been co-published, co-occurred with Alzheimer's that have not co-occurred with protomoors. And what we're able to do, as you can see here to the right here, is that we have a weighting system. The higher the weight, the more frequency that we feel that in the very near future that protomoors and these particular concepts are going to co-occur in the future. Now, why is that important to a researcher? It saves them a lot of time. It puts a bright light on where scientific research is heading. And that's what we call hypothesis generation. Again, taking the same information and put into a fingerprint, it allows us to allow the researcher to do a conceptual search with the visualization. Here you see this particular concept of arteriosclerosis, where if the researcher wanted to zero in on inflammation, they can click on inflammation and add that into their search result, and that will narrow down the search for them. Or they could look at the experts and look at the experts who have published in this particular area and focus on those folks. As you can see here with our expert profile page, we're able to show you who are the currently active experts, who are the experts with more than 290 publications, and a list of all of the experts. This particular application we have in partnership with Thomson Reuters, where we have married together their Web of Science data with our knowledge discovery tool. Now, when you look at science as a collaborative effort, as an STM publisher, you want to consider and think about how do you support a researcher in the area of collaboration and networking. This morning, Mr. Bly, he spoke about the very importance of researchers needing to collaborate. You need to think about how do you support a researcher in finding potential collaborators in interdisciplinary areas. As we know, interdisciplinary science is fastly growing over the last few years and continues to grow as these areas of research intersect each other. How do you allow a researcher to effectively manage his network of collaborators? How do you support the researchers in reaching out to a group of researchers and working on the same research question? And basically, it's looking at all of this data that you have and how do you organize it in a way that makes it useful to your audience. In the past, networking between researchers has taken place mostly at conferences, such as the one we're attending here. It's in the context of societies. It has taken place over email, as the gentleman alluded to this morning, that the Internet was created for scientists. The new social networking way of using semantic technologies is about to cannibalize this form of networking with new generations of scientists entering the scene. And maybe cannibalize is a bit harsh. I think it's going to enhance. I think the meetings that they're attending and the normal means of communicating, they're going to continue to do that, is that it's going to provide them new tools. Now, are scientists served well with platforms like LinkedIn, Facebook, and MySpace? To some degree, yes. To a large degree, no. These platforms are not specific to their particular discipline, their particular area of expertise, but they do have some very nice functionality. However, the content of the STM products can be used to establish pre-populated social networks supporting very specifically the needs of the target group, which means that the hard work has already been done because the path of the scientist has already been laid, their research record, their history. If you look at the Smith, Taylor, and Fawcett, the disambiguation challenge, before you can begin to suggest collaborators, you need to know who your experts are, which is sometimes very challenging with the author names, as we know. Disambiguation of authors is a crucial success factor for the pre-populated social networks. We have developed a sophisticated process to achieve this, and we have applied this to all the articles in PubMed. Using PubMed as a source, Collexis has created 1.8 million disambiguated expert profiles in our free social networking site, biomedexperts.com. This is a free site that we launched in January of 2008. It has over 170,000 registered users, generating over 3 million page downloads, page views. Well, what are the key ingredients for pre-populated STM network? Well, number one, your users, your experts, the relationships between those users, and that could be a co-author relationship. It could be a collegial relationship, which normally is a co-author relationship. There's a common interest to make it interesting to join. Why should I invest my time into this professional network? What am I going to gain from it? And it's a possibility to solve technical challenges like the author disambiguation. In our view, those are the key things that you need to think about. Not limited to these, but those are the key things. Again, looking at authors, co-authors, affiliations, the society journals, and solving the problem. Turning social networks into really high-producing, high-effective, professional scientific communities. This is just a screenshot of BioMed experts. Again, based off of the fingerprint, we're able to aggregate a expert's research profile and to aggregate all of the key concepts. If you were to click on any one of these key concepts, you would be able to see the publication that it came from, the abstract, not the full text, because I know that's a very sensitive topic with the publishers. Here you see his co-author network. The inner circle is the co-authors. The outer circle is the co-authors of the co-authors. The 6 degrees of science, it works, 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, works in science as well. Folks have heard me say it's actually 3.4. We've done the algorithm for it. And what's interesting is that Christian Herzog, our managing director, who has published a couple of articles, he's actually connected to this particular Mello through someone that has published an article with Hoffman, who's published an article with Plaster, who's published an article with Mello. So it shows how the links are. So if you are a new recent PhD doctorate candidate and you're trying to break into a particular network, you can see who's connected to who in the top authors around the world. Also, we have done the author name disambiguation. We've also done the city, state, geography disambiguation. So you can see where your network is around the world. So if you were traveling to any one of these countries, you can click on a box and see who is in your network, immediately see their profile, contact them. You're going to be in town. You want to talk about a project you want them to work with. So it allows them to get access to this information very quickly. From there, you can create sub-networks. Like, to give an example, Johns Hopkins is a customer of ours. They had a particular problem of their community not knowing who was doing what research. So they actually built a coffee shop in Johns Hopkins Medical School. And at their retreat, they asked, well, how's the coffee shop doing? Someone said, great coffee, great conversations, but it still doesn't solve my problem of knowing who within our organization is working on a similar disease that I'm working on. So they called us in, and we established an institutional profile of all of their experts. Now, what Johns Hopkins has done is that they've taken another step. They've taken their institutional dashboard of their expert profiles, and they've put it up on the web for free. And the reason why that they have done that is that they want to promote to the world their expertise. So if someone is ill, they're looking at where they should take their loved one for care, they'll look at Johns Hopkins. Also, the NIH, as I mentioned, they're a customer of ours. Not only do we evaluate, we're able to evaluate all of the grant applications that come in for the NIH, but we've also profiled their 8,000 researchers, and then we're able to determine, based upon someone's research profile, who is the best person to evaluate this grant application. Also, free of conflict, because we're able to show on a historical basis when someone has either co-authored a paper with someone or they've coexisted in a particular facility with someone. Also, I'm sure a lot of you have heard about the Clinical Translation Science Awards that the NIH has been working on for the last few years. And this is a platform comprised of those 43 institutions of all of their experts. So if you're a Colexis Institutional Dashboard customer, you get access to this dashboard. But it immediately allows you to find within these 43 institutions by a concept who is the person that I want to talk to about a very specific research disease category. Also, recently we launched the peer reviewer identification, again, which allows you to do a number of things. For a publisher, it allows you to have a tool for your editors to be able to find the right peer review group folks based upon a particular person's paper. So you plug the paper into the engine. It's fingerprinted, and then we come back with a result set of authors whose fingerprint matches the author of the submitting author. So immediately, you can expand your peer review group in a matter of seconds without the normal phone calls and emails and whatnot. Also, for grant applications, you can plug this in. The NIH uses this, as I indicated, to determine who is best to review a grant application within their organization based upon their research profile. So, you know, does it make sense for a researcher to join 25 different networks? How many of you belong to LinkedIn? Okay. Keep your hand up if you also belong to Facebook. Plaxo? Zing? Yeah. Three is my limit. I can't take any more. Now, Terry Hobart, he probably belongs to about five or six because he loves Tripit and all those other gadgets. Hey, Terry, how you doing? But the problem is that the researcher doesn't have time to join all of these different networks. So what you want to do is to make sure that you want to have this information to be aggregated into one set. So to have a researcher to belong to 25 different sub-networks, their information is going to be spread all over. What I've seen happen in the industry, in Facebook, LinkedIn, Plaxo, and Salesforce.com, I was at a conference a couple weeks ago, they have opened up their platforms to each other. And they're now allowing folks to move their profiles from one platform to the other. They were all up on the stage, and someone asked the question, well, aren't you concerned about who's going to win? They said, we want the end user to win. So it means that some of us go away, then so be it. And we have to think open like this in science as well, because at the end of the day, we want the best content to win. Not necessarily the best publisher. And allowing the best content to win is going to advance science. So with BioMed Experts, we have an umbrella network that is available. It's complete. The author names are disambiguated. It's maintained. And it's ready to be integrated into any particular platform. One profile, one login, and many networks. So when you look at this whole area, you have a subnetwork of all authors of one publisher, a subnetwork for a society, for a journal, for a reviewer assignment, virtual conferences, network of participants, network of funded researchers. It's bringing all this information, allowing folks to do what they do best, and that is to conduct research and move forward. So is making these networks and services possible, not theoretically, it's already a reality, which means that where there is metadata, it has become the content. So I want to thank you for your time this morning. If you have any questions.
Is there any questions for Darrell?
I'm sorry? Open ID. It will be. It's not there yet, but we are going to add the Open ID functionality. That's a very good question. To give you an example, there's a particular consortium in Russia where we've created one for nanotechnology. We've also, in partnership with the University of South Carolina, have created an ontology for hydrogen fuel cells, which we have a hydrogen fuel cell dashboard. So we're taking it, we're a small company, we're taking it one project at a time, and as we build these ontologies, we're rolling out the applications. But it's one thing that's key. We do need an ontology or taxonomy or thesaurus to work with our 18 algorithms. Eventually, yes, we do. Right now at the NIH, we actually have a full-time employee as part of our agreement with them that works with their folks on expanding their ontology every day. So. And we're able to use that and plug it back into our fingerprints. It's a moving target. That's the thing. It's always a moving target.
All right, that's all. We'll move on to Chris. Okay. Thank you, Darrell.